time.
Good evening, you guys. I'm KQ, Romeo, India, Whiskey. Am I there? KQ, RIW. Trying to decide which is the best way to go in. At this time, we begin the technical net. Meeting of the clan of guys who are curious about how radio works, how wireless equipment works, how to make it work better. They want to understand what's really going on. So if you've got curiosity, you're in the right place. People come to this particular net with questions about the equipment they're building, the antennas they're fiddling with, the transmission lines they're trying to make work better, and so on. Most of the time they get their questions answered, and no guarantee, occasionally there's some errors, but it's a peer-reviewed kind of material. By that I mean everything that you hear on the TechNet gets recorded. A very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has a website where the last 9 years, I think it is, of TechNet are completely recorded. So you go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back all the TechNets. By way of that process, people review those, and when they find errors, they let us know about it, and we correct it. So we're not 100% accurate. Nobody is. As I've often said in the engineering world, no engineer bats 1,000. Let me drop. They're very loose schedule that we keep. We almost don't keep. During the first hour or so, depending on enthusiasm, we take general questions. People sign in because they do have a question or a comment, and we approach them in the order in which they signed in. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who keeps track of the mailbag. People who don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly or don't have the license yet, they submit questions to him, and he chooses some of those that are of general interest, and we discuss them. Along the way, Hal, K60BZ, our celebrity on the repeater, the man with the airplane in his front yard in Oceanside, he has a lot of experience and a lot of radio equipment, so he gives us his impressions from time to time. Hal brags about the fact that he can give the brief discussion, and I give the more complete one. And whether or not we should be more brief or more complete is a subject that's always in question. Let me drop it. There was a period of time, about a year or two ago, in which as people signed in for a few weeks, I asked them, do you want us to be brief or more complete? And almost everyone said, please be more brief. But when you get to my subject, I want to hear the whole. I want to hear everything. Don't be brief on my subject when you get to it. Almost everybody answered that question. I often get on my hobby horse of antennas, my favorite subject, and sometimes I go off the deep end. Well, had I announced ahead of time that I'm going to be giving a talk on antennas, everyone would accept it. If someone asks a question on antennas and I give an extended discussion, then some people think it's too long. The bottom line is you can never please everybody. By way of all the emails that John and I get, the majority are pleased. They keep signing up, they keep coming back, and this is going on the 33rd year. In September, it'll be 33 years of the TechNet, which began in September of 1982. Let me drop. So from one point of view, we appear to be successful. That is to say, the total number of hours on the air of the TechNet during its 33 years is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson was on the air during his 30 years of the Tonight Show. So somebody is listening. Somebody thinks we should come back, otherwise it would have disappeared a long time ago. One other concept I want to get across to you guys, and that is the subject of dumb questions. There is no such thing as a dumb question. We have all been subjected to an elitist instructor who says, hey, that question is below our dignity. I'm not going to even answer it. We don't have that philosophy. Our philosophy on the TechNet is that if a person has a very basic, very low-level sounding question, it really represents a question that represents the biggest difference between what he knows and what he wants to know. Therefore, it's the question that's most deserving of an answer. It's kind of dumb to think about it any other way. So don't worry if you think your question is dumb. Go ahead and ask it. We don't accuse people of having dumb questions. And sometimes if you're not familiar with the with the material, and you don't use the right vocabulary, people will, in other venues, they will curse you out, so to speak, for using the wrong vocabulary. We don't do that either. That's one of the main reasons why I like giving answers directly, real-time, word of mouth, so to speak, on the TechNet. Let me drop. And I definitely promise that most of the time you will not get an answer from me in writing. There are people who would like to believe they're going to get free consulting service in writing if they write me an email. Well, as you can tell, one-third of the time when a person asks a question, by the time you go back and forth with the question, you suddenly realize that the words he used at first and the question he's asking don't go together. You know, with writing, you can waste an awful lot of time. With verbal back and forth, you find out real fast what the guy's really talking about, and you get to the real subject, if you know what I mean. So for me, it works a lot better that way. I can talk 150 words a minute. I probably type 10 words a minute. I'm a very slow typer. So you're not going to get the written answers from me in general. Okay, the way a person signs into the technical net is to give John, Hal, and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're just listening. After 32.9 years of TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. And I'm also not going to ask, does anybody have any emergency traffic? Everybody who runs the net asks that question, and they never get an answer. You have to keep doing it. I don't know how that got started. It's a crazy tradition. All right, so give me your call letters and name. A typical sign-in might sound like this, WYQU, Mike, and yes. Sure wish Mike would sign in more often. P2RIW listening, go right ahead with your sign-in.
N2HUH, yes.
And Mr. HUH, your name is?
I think it's Andy from Woodhaven, Queens.
Very fine, Andy. So, HUH, Andy, is the first sign-in. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2HRO, Joe, yes.
Okay, HRO, we got you, Joe. Next person to sign, give me your call letters and name.
KB1HQJ, Tim, no.
Okay, Tim with a no. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now.
KB2IXB, John, yes.
Okay. Was that Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Bravo? Is that what it was, John? Go ahead.
That's affirmative.
Very fine, John. Some of your letters were a little hard to make sure without the phonetics. One last call. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your name and call letters right now.
S2N, Paul, with this evening's Space Report. Good evening, fellas.
Very fine, Paul. Paul will be giving us Space Report number 164 of the series. And this, by the way, is TechNet number 1571 of the series that began in September of 1982. One last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, there being none. N2HUH, what's going on over there in Queens? And we'll discuss anything except antennas, and that's a joke. You got it, Andy.
You must be psychic, that's what I have. Okay, Dick, Internet. I have a circular polarized satellite antenna, let's say 70 centimeters, and I want to use it for possibly both vertical and horizontal polarization. Is it worth the trouble to modify the ballon that comes with it, or is it modifiable so that I can choose between vertical and horizontal polarization, or should I just leave it alone, and am I only getting a 3 dB loss for vertical and horizontal, being that it's circular, or is the dB loss more than that? Back to net.
Yeah, it's a good question, Andy. Even among the antenna engineers, quite a few of them feel a bit uncomfortable when it comes to circular polarization. They're not quite sure what really is going on. In the case of a horizontally polarized antenna, if you could see that wave, you would see the energy bouncing back and forth horizontally as far as the voltage is concerned, the E field, and the H field, you'd see bouncing back and forth, or vertically, at right angles to each other, but that would be linear horizontal polarization. If you could see a circular polarized wave and slow it down, it would look like a corkscrew. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at the E field or the H field. Each one would be independently creating a corkscrew. The bottom line of all that is that whenever you make real good circular polarization, you're putting half your power into the vertical and half your power into the horizontal. And if you're talking to somebody that's purely horizontal, close by, he only sees half that power. You do suffer a 3 dB loss. Now, is a 3 dB loss worth fighting for with reconfiguring the antenna with relays and bypassing the hybrid and whatever? And there's no good answer for that one. It's a matter of what you're trying to do. If you're doing moon bounce, where the guys specialize in circular polarization on some of the bands, circular is the right way to go. Also, when it comes to talking to guys that are horizontally polarized on the 432 sideband portion of the band and vertically polarized when it comes to the 450 FM portion of the band, you've got an advantage of being circular polarized. You're covering both groups at a 3 dB loss to each. Also, as you drive an automobile, let me drop. You think the signal you're listening to is purely horizontal, but you drive an automobile under normal conditions, the polarization you receive, thoroughly random. I found that out by the 6 months that I worked at the Romare Development Center in Utica, New York. And I was driving up there with a 2-meter sideband rig, 200 watts in the car. That was a Mirage amplifier. The one that's rated for 180 watts, but mine will put out 200 watts when the generator was cranking out 14.5 volts. And I had two antennas on the roof of the car, a mag mount square loop antenna that's horizontal, and a 5/8 wave whip antenna that's vertical. And I had a relay in the car alongside of the driver's seat where I could flip the switch back and forth between horizontal and vertical. And I would be talking to people over a 200 mile range, particularly the guy in southern New Jersey. I can't think of his call letters right now. There were times when I talked to him in southern New Jersey while I'm up in Utica, where there's a mountain range in between us. The bottom line is, as I switch back and forth between horizontal and vertical while I'm driving on the New York State Thruway, there was no difference. He was transmitting pure horizontal polarization with 4 2-meter Yagis, horizontally polarized, a moon bounce rig on the top of a 100 feet of tower in southern New Jersey. He's transmitting pure horizontal, and I'm flipping back and forth between horizontal and vertical as I drive along the freeway, and there was no difference. It sounded the same. Some occasional dropouts, yes. When I got to a scenic overlook where I had now 30 miles of range for the air, yes, in that case I would hear a stronger signal horizontal and vertical. But when that signal sifts through all of those trees and buildings and everything else to get to my mobile antenna on that New York State Thruway, the polarization becomes thoroughly random. It's hard to believe that when a signal bounces, let me drop. When a signal bounces at, let's call it, a 45 degree angle off of a piece of material, a horizontal polarization can become vertical. You can get polarization randomness in the real world. So leaving it circular, except for a slight 3 dB of disadvantage, it's something that's got some definitely desirable characteristics to it. And if you're worried about the 3 dB disadvantage, you can always increase your transmitter power by 3 dB. And if you want to have complete polarization adaptability, polarization agility, yes, you can put in a set of relays. It's going to be a fair amount of effort on your part, and you can do it. And there are certain times when you use pure horizontal or pure vertical, you will see a 3 dB advantage some of the times. Is it worth the effort? That's a function of what's on your priority list, so to speak, Andy. If you're really putting in a better transmission line and you're in the process of building a higher power transmitter, you're going to get more bang for the dollar out of those. But once you've done all of those things, and you want the last little bit of benefit of having polarization circular and linear by way of relays and switches, you can transmit pure horizontal, pure vertical, slant 45 degree horizontal to the right, slant 45 degrees polarization to the left, clockwise circular and counterclockwise circular. If you've got enough relays and the quarter wavelength transmission line that you plug in and plug out, you now have the ability to transmit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different polarizations. horizontal, vertical, slant right, slant left, clockwise, counterclockwise. You can select the six polarization types if you weren't willing to put in the right kind of relays. And would you get enough benefit, enough of the time to make it worthwhile? That's up to you. It's a matter of, as I said before, your priority list. Unfortunately,
repeater, timeout.
You asked a kind of a question, should you make the change? And I told you where the minefield is, I told you the variables involved, and you have to make the decision on that one. I like having polarization adaptability under certain circumstances. On a microwave dish, where you've got a horizontal probe in the feed horn and a vertical probe in the round feed horn, there are certain times when that gives you an advantage. So if you're willing to put forth the effort, you'll get something out of it. But 3dB is half an S unit and a well-calibrated S meter, single strength meter on the receiver. And so it's not, most of the time, it's not going to make or break a contact. During a very weak moonbounce contact, where sometimes one decibel of difference in the system's ability to transmit or receive, one or two decibels of difference can make a difference between a QSO and an NQSO, occasionally on moonbounce. But that's a rare circumstance. What you and I do on repeater work and terrestrial work, that quite often doesn't happen. So good luck with that project, and do come back and let us know what you've decided. N2HUH, K2RIW, you got to hear me.
Well, thank you, Dick. Barry, Mr. Moonbounce told me basically the same thing, but now I'm satisfied. I'd like to ask a vertical instead of a question, if I may, because usually I work every Sunday, and I don't get a chance to check into the TechNet. So if you can indulge me, because this may be my only chance to check in for the year.
Fire away, Andy. You got it.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding vertical antenna, ground mounted, you know, no specific radial system, random, whatever. Let's say I have butternut vertical, wall band vertical, let's just say or at least 40 and 80 meters. And physically, we know it has coils and sometimes capacitor networks on it, but basically, physically, it's 30 feet long. And let's say I took that thing and I threw it, I just cut it and chopped it off and threw it to the side somewhere, and I put up a 30-foot piece of pipe and used my antenna tuner to load up on the same frequency on 70 meters, I mean on whatever, 80 meters and 40 meters. Basically, with the antenna, with the person on the other end, rather, hear the same signal, whether I'm using a 30-foot piece of pipe that I tuned on my antenna tuner, as opposed to the butternut vertical that just happens to be resonant at the same frequency. I hope I made that clear, N2HUH.
Yes, it did, Andy. I'm pretty sure I know what you're asking. And there's at least two variables involved. Efficiency of the antenna really determines how much power gets radiated to base in the direction of the guy you want to talk to, as opposed to heating up the local soil. Almost none of the antennas we build, use, buy, have inefficiency within the antenna itself. Inefficiency within the antenna, I mean, you transmit 100 watts into the antenna, key down for 5 solid minutes, turn off the transmitter and walk over there and touch everything. And if the antenna's working correctly, it's all going to be ice cold. Of all the 100 watts your transmission line puts into the antenna is going to attempt to radiate 100 watts of it. If you've got an inadequate ground plane, not enough ground plane radials, a substantial amount of that power can be coupled into the earth. The earth is a volumetric resistant material. You're heating up the earth and you don't even know it. The worms will be happy in the wintertime because of what you're doing. So the ground plane radials, how extensive they are, whether or not the antenna is all mounted above the ground, the radials above the ground are much more efficient, so to speak, because the signal doesn't get a chance to sneak in between those radios and light up the earth. So ground plane radials make a real big difference. But if it was a half-wave resonator, half-wave electronically, you know, with loading coils and top hat capacitors and zigzagging, let me drop. If it's a halfway resonator where you're feeding it from the outer end, where you've got an impedance of 1,500 ohms instead of 35 ohms of a ground plane radio, of an ordinary quarter-wave ground plane, then the efficiency due to inadequate ground plane radios changes by a whole lot. So that's another variable. But now, once you've wiped out what's going on with the difference on ground plane radios and how much of the energy is being coupled into the Earth, once we get by that variable in this case, the antenna itself, the magic words that I say so often that are not written in any book, the most important seven words, in my opinion, for an antenna designer is you resonate first, then it will radiate. As long as your piece of pipe is made out of low-loss materials like copper or aluminum, and good transmitting-grade capacitors and inductors and so on, as long as you're not making hot elements, as long as it resonates, it'll radiate. You put 100 watts into a piece of pipe that you've resonated with a antenna tuner that's mounted right at the antenna, so you're not getting extra feed line loss, so to speak. And the antenna could be very far out of resonance, but you've got a wide-range antenna tuner, and you forced it into resonance. Or it's the wrong length, and you've added loading coils and top hat capacitors and zigzags, and you've made it resonate. Once it resonates and radiates, and it's giving you a reasonably good impedance match, let me drop. You put 100 watts into that antenna, and 99 watts is going to be radiated into space. Now, whether that's some of that goes into the ground, we've already discussed. And then when it comes to the true antenna pattern, there are lots of articles written where a person says, I'm going to move that loading coil 6 feet up on the piece of wire, so now I've got a longer length of wire that's got a higher current flowing through it. Therefore, I'm going to get a lot more efficiency, as the word they use. Not true. By that I mean, as long as the antenna, by way of its antenna tuning structure, is forced into electronic resonance at your frequency, as long as it's made out of low-loss materials, you put 100 watts into it, 99 watts is going to be radiated out of that antenna. When it comes to changing the pattern of the antenna, you want a higher elevation angle, or you want a lower elevation angle. That takes real estate to do that. In other words, you're either going to make it a 5/8 wave radiator, which gives you a lower angle of radiation. You've devoted extra real estate, an extra length of material, in order to do the resonating, in order to do the radiating. Now you've got some control of the pattern, not a huge amount of control. If you want a whole lot of control, now you're going to make a vertical collinear. On VHF frequencies, you can do that, the so-called station master. Let me drop. And that gives you a whole lot of gain if you could see the antenna pattern out of one of those station masters, where it's got about five or so collinear vertical elements all stacked end to end. And that gives you a pancake antenna pattern. If you could see that antenna pattern, it would look like a pancake aimed at the horizon. And it's not wasting any time reading any of the signal up or down, all of it's on the horizon. That's where your gain comes from. But you've made an investment in real estate to do that. That antenna is going to be five or seven half wavelengths long, that station master. Until you invest in real estate, or you make a substantial difference, like 5/8 wave versus quarter wave, you're not going to get much of a change in the pattern. And so the real signal strength the other guy's going to hear is going to change by very minor amounts. Your highest priority is to make it resonate. Your second highest priority is to try to come into a reasonably low standing wave ratio as far as the feed line is concerned. After that, worry about the ground plane radios if it's a quarter wave radiator. If it's a half wave radiator, electronically, the radiator half wave long, you almost don't have to worry about the ground plane radios. One stake in the ground could be good enough. So these are some of the variables involved, Andy. N2HUH, G2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, again, that's the way I think it works, and thanks for confirming, and that actually does lead me to the second part to that question would be, let's say you have 80 meter vertical, and it's a quarter wave, and theoretically it'll work as a half wave for 40, but for whatever reason it's designed that it has a trap, whether it's inductor, capacitor, whatever, to make it a quarter wave on 40. How does the antenna choose which a half wave or a quarter wave? How does the radio choose, or how does the RF choose? I mean, it sounds almost like if it was a half wave, it would be more, actually more stable and more resonant as a half wave, even if it had a quarter wave network on it for 40 meters. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's just something that's bouncing around my head all of a sudden. And 2H2H.
Yeah, what I think you're asking, Andy, is how does the radio wave decide whether or not that antenna is quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave, with or without the trap, and so on? The radio wave doesn't decide. You decide. You're the antenna designer, and depending on how you set up those chokes and so on, you're really deciding that. Now, you may not know what you've decided when you've built it or assembled it, but you are really the determining factor. Is a kind of a half-wave antenna. The popular half-wave antenna, half-wave collinear, station master-like antenna. You take it apart, you got a whole lot of pieces of semi-rigid coaxial cable in there. Each piece of semi-rigid coaxial cable is electronically a half-wavelength long, and we each one of them comes together with the next one. The antenna conductor and the outer conductor crisscross. So at the point of junction of half-waves, you want 180 degrees of phase shift. And at first it sounded like the upper antenna is going to be out of phase with the lower antenna. Well, you're comparing the upper end of the lower one with the lower end of the upper one. You do want 180 degrees of phase shift at that point in order for those two half-wavelength collinear things to be in phase with each other, as far as the current flowing through the center is concerned, is one way of looking at it. So by that design, by that way of setting it up, you have forced the upper and lower to be in phase with each other on that particular junction that I'm now describing. Let me drop. Because there's 180 degrees of phase shift at that point, there is a kind of collinear antenna where you make it out of one solid piece of wire instead of individual pieces of semi-rigid coax cable. And now in order to make 180 degrees of phase shift at each half-wavelength junction, you build a trap at that point, an LC resonator. It could be a hairpin, or it could be a real inductor and capacitor. And when that inductor and capacitor is set up just right, you do get 180 degrees of phase shift at that point. And it's a kind of design that's simpler to build mechanically, but you pay a price for that. In general, it's a much more narrow-band antenna than the normal station master, so I'm not recommending that method of construction. But putting in a choke at the right point can create 180 degrees of phase shift. Now, there's a kind of a multi-band dipole antenna that people use on 80-40-20, where there are chokes in certain points. There are resonators in certain points along that wire. Let me drop. In some cases, on 80 meters, you're lighting up the whole piece of wire with all of its resonators. On 40 meters, you're only lighting up the center section, and the resonator becomes a kind of a choke that doesn't allow a signal to flow through the rest of the wire, is one way of looking at it. And depending on how you set it up mechanically, you can make it in such a way that the next piece of wire also is getting some of the signal and radiating the signal in phase. So there's a zillion ways of designing an antenna. And once you start putting inductors, capacitors, chokes, resonators, and whatever along the length of the wire, unfortunately, you've got so darn many variables involved that it becomes a little bit complicated to understand what you're doing, how it's working, and so on. Some of the computer modeling programs will help. But the good news is that there's a lot of knobs on this front panel, so to speak, of this thing called the antenna. And if you use all those knobs, you can do quite a bit of magic. To learn how to use all those knobs, I'll admit, takes a fair amount of study. Let me drop. In my opinion, a guy working for the antenna development department of a good company needs an apprenticeship more than 10 and close to 20 years before he knows most of the rules of thumb and most of the tricks that can be used in antenna design, impedance matching, broadbanding, and so on. The books do a mediocre job. The classes do less than a mediocre job of teaching that art and science. So don't be discouraged by the fact that it's complicated. It's worth digging into because, as you can tell, there's a lot of capability in that simple piece of wire that you call antenna and that simple choke that you put in there. Putting it in the right place, tuning it the right way, You've got a lot of variables. Don't be discouraged by the fact that it's complicated. It's worth digging into because once you understand what's going on, it'll give you pleasure and it'll give you performance, and it might even make you rich. I say that with tongue-in-cheek. Yes, as an antenna designer, as a consultant for the last 15 years, did give me a lot of money because it's a rare art and science, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Andy. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I'm satisfied. No problem. Thank you very much for your help. And it's the same butternut vertical I used in 1990 or approximately the 90s when you and I used to talk when I was at Andy N2HOH in Brooklyn, New York about the severe interference problems I had. That's the same antenna. It's been serving me well and all these years, and I guess I'll look forward to asking you the next question next year if when I don't go to work. So again, thank you very much, and back to you. And I hope everybody enjoys the net N2HOH.
He got something, Dick, N2HOH.
Yep. Come back a little more often, Andy. And and maybe you can install an antenna at your place of work by which you can sign into us. So, think what I was going to say. Oh, okay. You got a comment on what we've discussed so far? A brief comment, Rich, N2HOH, KQIW.
No, it's something else.
Like it's...
Yeah,
okay, I'm going to put you on the list. WB2HRO. Joe? How are those electrons on your antennas treating you in Lego Park tonight? Lego? Lego Park. I'm pronouncing it wrong. You got it, Joe. K2LIW.
I have a phone call right now. Could the next person take the question? I come to take the third one.
You got it, Joe. Okay, Tim was next. Kilo Bravo 1, Hotel Quebec Juliet. Go right ahead, Tim. K2LIW in the TechNet. KB2, HQJ, K2RAW, go ahead, Tim. Oh, he did say he was only, sorry about that. He was just listening. The next person who signed in with a real question was John. Kilo Delta 2, India X-Ray Bravo. You've got it, John.
Thank you, Dick. That's Kilo Delta 2, India X-Ray, Papa.
Very fine, John. I made that correction, and please proceed with your question.
Thank you. Well, first I want to say thank you to you and to John and to all of the people who run the TechNet. I've been listening for 2 decades, even though I've only been a ham for about 2 months now. My question has got to do with antennas.
Gee, that's too bad, John, because we're not discussing antennas tonight. That's going to be next week. I'm pulling your leg, John. Go right ahead. Antennas are the best thing for us hams to discuss. Nobody builds an 8210-meter rig anymore, except for some QRP rigs. But, a modern-day rig has got 60 transistors and a bunch of integrated circuits. We don't build that anymore. We take it out of the box and plug it in. But the antennas are something we can definitely fiddle with. So antennas are a lot of fun. Over to you, John. KB2IXP, K2LIW.
Thank you, Dick. My antenna question is a little different. Back in the 70s, there was a company called Antenna Specialist, and they put out a monitor antenna called a Monitor 56. And I've been looking for the paperwork that went along with that, the technical specs and the instructions. For quite a while, it's not on the internet, and I can't seem to locate it. I was wondering if any of you gentlemen who've been around for a while know some place I could go that would have that information.
Okay, antenna specialist, a Monitor 56 antenna. I'll pass it over to the net and see if anyone has got the instruction sheet or any other information on that. However, once you look at that antenna with a ruler in your hand, and you measure the length of the radiator and look at whether or not it's got a tuning coil to it, whether or not it's a disc cone and so on. I mean, the antenna itself, if you opened up, if you go to a good technical library and open up an issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and there's four separate editions of that book, you'll eventually say, gee, that antenna looks just like a disc cone. Therefore, that's probably what it is. Once you find out what it is, you may not need the instruction manual, because instruction manual is primarily going to tell you how to tighten down the U-bolts, what kind of a mast you should mount it on, how far above the ground, what kind of a transmission line you feed into it. I mean, rarely does an antenna have such a radical kind of a design where the instruction manual is required in order for you to use it properly. It's kind of rare. So let me test it over to the net, see if anybody has antenna specialist monitor antenna called Monitor 56, manufactured a few decades ago. If anybody's got any information on that, and John's unable to find it on the internet, if you've got any information, give us your call letters right now, K2IW in the TechNet.
Be a good one for Hal, Dick.
Yeah, when Hal's around, we can ask him. There's a good chance that he has run into that antenna. And he's such a collector of manuals, there's a slim chance he's got the manual. And by twisting his arm, you might have to ask him to give you a Xerox copy of it. But in most cases, the instruction manual on the antenna is not required. I will admit, if it was something like a tri-band beam, got a whole bunch of individual elements that have to be put together in the right order, and you don't want to mix them up left to right, forward and aft, and so on, the instruction manual might really be required. But on something called a monitor antenna, which I'm guessing is vertically polarized, somewhat broadband, I'm not sure you need the instruction manual. So let's see if we can find that for you. But describe the antenna physically, John. What does it look like? KD2IXP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And it has four radials which proceed down from the base plate at about a 45 degree angle. And there's a monopole in the center which is about 5 feet high, and it has two resonators in line in the vertical. It's not a disc cone. It is a wideband monitoring antenna, supposed to be 25 to 1300 megahertz.
Okay, that does sound like a multi-band kind of antenna with those resonators. And my guess is the one nice piece of information you'd like to have is what is the standing wave ratio versus frequency across 25 megs to 1,300 megahertz. However, since it's called monitor antenna, which implies that it's being used on a receiver, even if you had the curve of standing wave ratio versus frequency, even if portions of the curve had 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, which is an alarming amount of standing wave ratio if you're going to transmit through it, because some transmitters won't tolerate that much as well. The good news is that a receiver is amazingly tolerant. In many cases, the receiving antenna you use can have as much as a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, and it'll work like a charm. And if you corrected the standing wave ratio completely from 10-to-1 down to 1-to-1, you'll get a couple of dB of increase on the signal strength meter, but on many of the frequencies we use, the signal-to-noise ratio will not change. You can, the best example I can give of this is that you can take a random length of wire, a clip lead, that's a couple of feet long, and you plug it into the center conductor on the back of your 80 through 10 meter transceiver, and you just go receiving with that random length of wire. And the guys you hear on 80, 40, and 20 meters will sound almost the same as they do when you have a real, properly made antenna installed in the air. They'll sound almost the same. You won't get as much S-meter deflection, but on HF frequencies you can get away with that, because although the antenna might be, because of very high standing wave ratio, not very efficient at coupling the signal from the antenna into the receiver, that inefficiency...
Repeater, timeout.
That inefficiency is affecting how much noise you hear off the band, as well as how much signal you hear off the band, and it's got an equal amount of detriment of the noise input versus the signal input. Therefore, although you don't get as much S-metered deflection, the signal-to-noise ratio sounds the same. You can get away with that on HF frequencies, up to about 20 meters or 15 meters. When you start getting into VHF, 6 meters and above, the noise in the band is so much quieter that you don't have that advantage. Now, the real disadvantage of a high-vis while receiving antenna is you do hear a little bit less signal-to-noise ratio. So, a monitor antenna used in the receiver mode. As I said, the receiver is amazingly forgiving. And so it's nice to know what that standing wave ratio is. By way of you borrowing somebody's antenna analyzer, or one of these swept VISWAR things made by AEA or MFJ, you could plot the real standing wave ratio versus frequency if you wanted to. So one last call. If anybody knows where they can get a hold of a manual on the antenna that was a couple of decades old, called Antenna Specialist is the brand name, and it was called the Monitor 56 antenna. If you happen to know where a data sheet on that is, let us know. We're gonna drag our feet a little bit before I turn it over to John. K2IXP with some delay for anyone who's got that data. K2I, W in the tech net. Over to you, John, with some delay.
There's a deafening silence, Rick Dick. Thank you very much for your time. Just another thought while I have you on the radio. I'm going to be putting up a tri-band vertical, and I want to feed it with Belden 9913. Is that a decent wire for this?
Most of the time the answer is yes. There is an early version of 9913. Which was quite poor a couple of years downrange, where it would suck up water and give you a lot of extra loss. The modern version of 9913 has got a very good, almost hermetic seal, a foil layer underneath the braid, which stops it from sucking up water. So as long as you do a good job of sealing the end so that water doesn't get into the antenna, 9913 can be a pretty good cable for people using it, the modern version, and they're happy with it. The best deal in the transmission lines in the world is 70 ohm hardline used by the cable TV companies. You go to the right stockyard where they buy it in 5,000 foot reels, and there's 150 foot left at the end of the reel, and they bring the reel back to the stockyard, and they got a few of them there. And you talk the guy into selling you one of those reels for some nominal price. You get an extremely low loss out of that 70 ohm hardline, half inch, three quarter inch, 9/7/8 of an inch and a quarter, comes in various diameters. A little bit difficult to find the right connector to put on the end of it. And the average guy will lose a lot of sleep at night thinking that, hey, that's a 70-ohm cable, and I've got a 50-ohm antenna. That's a 1.4 standing wave ratio. Don't worry about it. So it's so damn low in loss. And the cable itself, if you bought, let me drop it. If you bought the equivalent from Andrew Heliax, you'd pay $2, $3, $5 a foot. and you can get 150 feet of it for about $15, if you know what I mean, if you talk the guy into it correctly at the stockyard. So that's the lowest loss in transmission lines in the world. 9913 is good stuff. That, and I'm trying to think of the other very popular one nowadays that people are using. Can't think of it right now.
400.
LMR 400, yeah, that's the one. LMR 400 is another very popular one. I thank you, Eric, I think that was. So good luck with that project, and let us know how you turn out with that one, John. Now we're going to go back to Joe, W2, Hotel Romeo Oscar. You got it, Joe, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, WB2HRO. Well, a good row on transmission lines and antennas. And my question is, there's a couple of questions about antennas. One is, what's the most practical all band, you know, 80 or 160, depending on how long you make it, to 10 meter antenna? I'm thinking, well, here at home I have a very limited installation. I have about 50 plus feet of wire hanging out my window, running off of the STC 239 tuner, with the counterpoise being the windowsill and the frame of the building. And it works fairly well. But at City College, where I run the school station, W2HJ, this time last year, we put up an antenna, which is 200 feet of wire, random wire, and then an antenna tuner, the SDC-231. And I'm thinking of, there's so many, you know, over the year, and you know that I talk to people. Let me see if I have it. So like a random dipole, a dipole that will work on all the bands. And some people feed it with 600 ohm line. I have miles of 80 strand wire with 600 volt insulation in 150, 100 foot length. I must have 2,000 feet of it. I'd like to use that. I'm using some of that for the long wire antenna now. But what do you think about making a dipole that, or a loop, and feeding it with a 100 ohm wire going from there to the coax to the shack?
As I hear it, Joe, your highest priority is to make an antenna work reasonably well in 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters. Because at that radio station at your school, they'd like to use each of those bands. And under normal circumstances, I would recommend a fan dipole, because it's got individual dipoles on each one of those bands. But to string that at a school, it's a sort of an elaborate structure. The antenna I ran into with Rich into EO's help, and I helped install one a week ago, is the Cobra Compact antenna. Now, when you look at this thing, it looks like one dipole approximately 75 or 78 feet long, but the wire of the dipole looks like a heavy gauge equivalent of the ribbon cable that you use for feeding a rotator. So this is a one piece of wire to the left and to the right. The total tip-to-tip distance on this thing is like 75 feet long, and it works on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters. What they've done, what Mr. Cobra has done, is he's taken the four leads of that ribbon cable, and he's cut them in certain places and shorted them out in certain places at the ends and the beginning, such that it is a wrapped dipole-like thing. It's a multi-resonant frequency dipole-like antenna. It's fed with 450 ohm ladder line. Does an awful good job. Not a very expensive antenna. Doesn't take up a lot of room. Doesn't have a lot of unsightliness to it. It gives you all of those bands right away. Good job. So having seen one of those things, I think it's 73 feet end to end. Having seen one of those things and installed it, Barry and I, N2MB, actually installed it between a couple of trees on the Rich's property. Looks like a lot of antenna for the money and for the amount of hardware. Now, you've got an awful lot of pieces of wire where you could put up a full wavelength loop on 80 and 40. You can feed with 600 ohm line. You can use antenna tuners. There's another whole art and science to putting up a loop antenna. There are people who think that a loop antenna has a whole lot of extra performance compared to a properly operating 80-meter dipole at the same altitude. And if you combine that with the experiments that were done by Mel, K2KEY, he experimented with feeding the 600 ohm ladder line that went to his full wavelength 80 meter loop. He fed it in such a way with a more elaborate version of an antenna tuner where he could feed it ordinary differential signal, in other words, the two leads of the 600 ohm line. At one instant in time, you're making one positive and you're making the other one negative, so to speak, on the first half cycle. That's the differential mode. And by way of the controls he added to his antenna tuner, he could slowly slide from the differential mode to the common mode. In other words, he feeds the right-hand side and left-hand side both a positive signal on the first half cycle. And he could slowly slide between the two. Let me drop. What Mel discovered is that when that full wavelength loop of wire in the air is fed that way with that variable antenna tuner arrangement that he made, he was really doing electronic antenna steering. In other words, whether or not the main lobe of the antenna came out north and south versus east and west, he had a certain amount of variable of that. I think of it, he was also changing polarization to some degree. So once you decide to build a loop antenna and you use all of its capability with this differential versus common mode feeding arrangement, boy, that's a fun antenna. wire itself, the average neighbor of yours doesn't see wire. No matter how much wire you've got in the air, no matter how many antennas you've got, it's never enough. The price is not very high. Just to get on the air on 8310 meters right off the bat, easily, this Cobra has got a lot to do with it, a Cobra compact antenna. However, at a later time, you start adding long wires, loop antennas, loops with loading coils and so on. The antenna experiments that you can do with those students, Joe, there's no end to it. Each antenna has got its advantages and disadvantages, but wire is cheap. You can put a lot of it in the air, and your neighbors don't see it. So it's not a matter of choosing which antenna you put up. It's a matter of choosing which antenna you put up first, second, and third. You're going to be putting up multiple antennas eventually, in my opinion, Joe. WB2HRO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree. And I think since we have now the 200 feet of wire that runs practically, it follows the roof line of the building, I want to do another long wire that goes to an adjacent building or two buildings away where it'll run in free space upward at an angle, you know, at about, well, maybe a 30 or 45 degree angle. I want to try that because right now we're not too far away from the building, which has various metal components. It's not a modern building, so it has a lot of wood and masonry, but it also does have some steel in it. So we want to thinking of something a little different. And a quick question before you go. Make 600 ohm line out of what I have. Someone told me that it should be 7.6 centimeters apart would give me 600 ohms for 18 wire.
Yeah, to make 600 ohm line, you have a very small variable as far as the diameter of the wire is concerned, a much bigger variable as to what is the spacing between the two. And 600 ohm line, there's nothing magic about that exact number 600. If your method of construction gave you 531 ohm transmission line, it would work like a charm. There's nothing magic about exactly 600, exactly 450, exactly 300. But if you wanted, if you want to really be a good scientist and know that you've got an exact impedance of your cable, you go to the reference data for radio engineers, and you will see a formula on the subject of transmission lines, one of its 45 chapters or so, on diameter of wire, spacing of wire, and what impedance you get. As I said, you get a minor variation with diameter of wire, you get a bigger variation with the spacing, but no impedance is magic, so don't worry about that. And so, looks to me like City College of New York is about to get quite a few more antennas, antlers, on its buildings, by way of your effort, as I see it, Joe. WB2HRO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, WB2HRO. Yes, it is. Right now, I'm thinking of feeding them with the antenna tuner that we have, but there are other ways I know that people do it, where they go through a baron into the coax, avoiding an antenna tuner. And the only reason I'm saying that, because if someone donates us an amplifier, our antenna tuner would burn up, because it's only good for 100 watts. You know what I mean? I'd have to go something that doesn't require. Now, what's the principle of G5RV? I used one this summer. It worked quite well. But it seemed like it's a dipole for 80, and it was cut short. It was only 102 feet long. And the vertical part, the 450 ohm line, how does that play into it? And is that radiating, or is that stretching stuff?
It's my belief, Joe, that is primarily a matching stub. Ladder line at HF frequencies almost never radiates. You can force it to radiate by giving it a very high common mode signal as opposed to a differential mode signal. When you're using ladder line under normal circumstances, you're using it as a differential mode component. In other words, at each inch of the time, the right-hand side is positive and the left-hand side is negative during that half cycle of the RF wave. That gives you a kind of cancellation as far as radiation is concerned. You can force ladder line to radiate, but now you're giving it a common mode signal, making both sides positive or both sides negative during that half cycle. Now it will radiate. And the fact that it's two wires side by side versus one wire, the radio doesn't see the signal, doesn't see the difference when you're feeding them in common mode. So that ladder line on the G5RV is primarily an impedance matching device. When you choose various lengths of coax cable, when you choose various lengths of transmission line, of various impedances and various fractions of a wavelength of each of those frequencies, you can get some very fancy impedance matching, the so-called quarter wave matching transformer effect. If I had a 100 ohm antenna and a 50 ohm transmitter, and somewhere along the line I put a quarter wavelength of 70 ohm cable, it will give me an exact impedance match between the 100 and the 50. It's a so-called quarter wave matching transformer. And it doesn't have to be a quarter wave. An odd number of quarter waves will do that. So what Lou Varney did with that antenna is to recognize that certain lengths of line on a dipole will reforce it back into resonance at most of those bands. Let me drop. However, almost everybody who builds a G5RV complains about the fact that on 10 meters, the standing wave ratio is extremely high. It takes a pretty wide band antenna tuner to work it well. So when it comes to 80, 40, 20, and 15, apparently he did a pretty good job, but on 10 meters, it didn't work out so well. And if somebody wanted to do a science experiment of putting a stub of ladder line, for instance, on just the right position of the ladder line that's there, guarantee there is a way of making the 10-meter impedance real good, real low standing wave ratio, at least on the center of the band where you tune it for. So I think it's only a matter of time before some smart guy comes along, makes an improvement to the G5RV that makes it work better on 10 meters. The technology is there, just like a matter of somebody knowing what he's doing and or using a good antenna or a modeling program to solve that problem. Lots of ways of building these antennas. The fact that your building is primarily wood means that even though your wire lays parallel to that roof, that's not much of a disadvantage. Once the wire itself resonates, it will radiate, even if there are things around it that are metallic, that are changing the resonant frequency. It doesn't matter. The only thing you care about, let me drop, is whether the things around the antenna are made out of lossy materials. I mean, if, for instance, the roof on the building is made out of a kind of tar that had a whole lot of carbon granules in it, so that it is conductive, so it's a volumetric resistive material. Now, in that case, it can suck up quite a bit of the RF, turn it into the heat, and you're going to get a low-efficiency antenna. That kind of macadam or tar on the roof of the building is very unlikely. So to make a building lossy, as far as antenna radiation is concerned, if you had to do that as a design, it would be extremely difficult. It almost never happens. Yes, the building is going to change your radiation pattern somewhat, but other than that, your eye sees that building at 80 and 40 meters. That building is primarily a transparent structure, a little bit like a bunch of monkey bars, and as long as the individual lengths of the wiring in the building and the plumbing, as long as those individual lengths don't hit resonance,